The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Maybe now I'll say just a few more words about mindfulness of the body. We're in the second talk of a 6-week series right now, looking at the Buddha's basic instructions on meditation, sometimes translated as the four foundations of mindfulness. And these instructions, the first of these four, is what we were doing in the meditation, this mindfulness of the body. And then it goes on to the next three foundations have to do with the mind in various ways. Mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mental states, and then mindfulness of dhammas, which is usually translated as phenomena or mind objects. And the instructions have a progression, we can say, maybe from, sometimes it's said from the grossest to the most subtle, or the easiest to see, to maybe the most difficult to see. You know, so, but it's not to say that mindfulness of the body is in any way a beginner's practice. I mean, it's a practice that the Buddha said can take us all the way to the end of the path. Just mindfulness of the body. Just mindfulness of breathing. So it's in a way simple, but it has can be a profound depth to it as we understand it and practice it. And one way of thinking about practice is that in each moment, you could say in each moment, there are two things that are happening. There's what's happening, you know, the content of the moment. And then there's the how. There's a how we're relating to what's happening. You know, there's what we're doing, and then there's how we're relating to it. So, usually, we're totally focused on the what. You know, we're totally focused on the content, you know, which makes sense in a way. I mean, if we're thinking about something, we're driving somewhere, we're, you know, we're completely involved with the story. You know, it's as if we're, you know, it's when we, you know, like watching a drama, a television show, or like we're at the movie theater, we get so immersed in the storyline. And then there can be some moments when if you've had this experience, you've like been in the movies and it's all these conditions are set up to allow us to absorb into the experience. You know, the lights are dark and the sound is up and big picture and everyone's, you know. And then we just get absorbed into the plot, the story, what's happening. But there can be some moments when we notice, we remember, oh, you know, this is just a movie. Or, you know, we start to notice the light that's streaming onto the screen. And, you know, we look around and we see everybody else who's completely disconnected from the body, disconnected from the usual ways we anchor ourselves in the present moment, and it's just the mind has gone into that. When we notice that it's a movie, when we notice that it's something that's conditioned, that's kind of fabricated, that's the shift from content to process. You know, I mean, it takes, it's almost no effort. You know, it's just simply noticing. It doesn't take more effort to notice the process than the content, but it's just the shift of perspective, shift of attention. So there's a way you could say that all of meditation practice is learning ways to shift our attention, learning ways of looking, ways of seeing, ways of understanding our experience that bring less suffering, less stress, more ease, more happiness, more freedom. You know, so it's just this shift of perspective. And so that's kind of the big picture of insight meditation, of mindfulness meditation. And then the invitation is to do this shift, to find new ways of looking with regard to the body, with respect to the body. And you think about maybe one reason why the body is such an important part of this path, such an important part of meditation, is because there's so much suffering, so much stress that can be connected to the body. Yesterday, I was teaching the teen group. I think it's called Mindful Teens. And we were talking about mindfulness of the body. And what came up over and over again for these teens is the suffering around body image. You know, how we think about our body, how we identify with our body, and especially this comparing mind that, you know, maybe it reaches a kind of intensity for teenagers, but I don't think it goes away necessarily with the teenage years. You know, and this comparing this body to other bodies, you know, how we think about, judge the body. So that's its own form of suffering around the body. And then the very nature of the body being something that is impermanent. You know, it's subject to aging, subject to change. The body is vulnerable, you know. Not only do I feel that as just as a person, as a human being, but now being a parent and having small children, you just see that once you have a body, anything can happen to the to that body, you know. And you know, so we're part of this physical world. We're part of this world that is impermanent, always changing, subject to just the inevitable and we say all phenomena are subject to impermanence. All phenomena come together, are like that in that form for a certain amount of time. It could be a millisecond, it could be 50 years, 100 years, and then that form comes apart. That form, you know, returns to emptiness. You know, and just the very basic truth that if we attach to this body, if we identify with this body, if we think that this body is who we really are, we're going to suffer. You know, because so in a way, that's one way of looking, a way of seeing. One perspective is that I am this body is me, I need to protect it, defend it, build it up with, build up its muscles or tone it or, you know. That's one perspective. And then maybe the request of practice is a kind of shift of learning to see the body in different ways. And so the Buddha offered a number of suggestions, instructions, which just significantly don't have anything to do with saying the body is bad, the body is wrong, or the body is our vehicle for the practice. And maybe one powerful way of taking care of this body, of cherishing this body, is doing what we're doing, is learning these other ways, these new ways of seeing the body, which bring a freedom of mind, which bring an ease and peace and release from suffering. So the Buddha taught a number of these ways. The most basic way is simply what we were doing, which is to connect to the experience of the body from the inside. You know, these connecting to all the sensations, the vibrations, the aches, the pains, the pleasure that's held in the body, without the filter of all of our ideas. So it's sometimes this is called a bare attention. You know, just feeling the body, experiencing the body exactly as it is in this moment, without needing to change it, without needing to fix it, but just with a lot of care, a lot of kindness, of compassion, just being with the experience of the body. I mean, in a way, it's so simple. And it's something we all know. We all intuitively know how to do this. Yet, we build up this conditioning. We build up these habits and these thoughts, which can sometimes cover over this connection to the body, which is really natural, which is really our birthright. So again and again, we just come back to the simple experience of the body. So this is kind of the basic, you know, the basic practice. The Buddha went on to talk about cultivating a kind of whole body awareness. You know, so when we're sitting in meditation, it can be possible to connect to these subtle sensations of the breath, sensations of the what it feels like to sit, the kind of weight of the body, the tingles, you know, all these little constituents of our experience of body. But it's not necessary to, you know, that again, that's one way of looking, one way of seeing the body, and it's very valuable to be able to do that, to be able to lay in bed before we go to sleep and just really connect with what, however the body is. Experience it can be wonderful, can be healing. So in moments of stillness, we have this tool. And then when we're walking, when we're moving around, when we're driving, maybe it makes sense to look, to see the body, to regard the body in another way, to have a kind of whole body awareness, you know, that's that we can kind of keep with us when we move, when we walk, when we cook. Again, this is it's very simple. It's not. It doesn't take a lot of practice to do this. What takes practice is that willingness to come back. The power of the mind, the power of the thinking is so strong that it's that willingness to come back to the awareness of the body. And part of having that willingness is just simply having the understanding that this is a valuable thing to do. That it's more valuable, it's more beneficial to connect with the body than to be lost in some story, some fantasy, some neurotic fear or worry or memory. Because there's a certain draw to that, there's a pull to that. You know, we all have that. And so part of this learning ways of learning new ways of being with the body counters those forces of distraction, those forces of habit in the mind. So there's this bare attention, connecting with the sensations of the body, being with the whole body awareness, awareness of the body and the different postures of standing, of sitting. So the Buddha talked about the four postures for meditation, which are standing, sitting, walking, and lying down. And there's no sense of a hierarchy, you know, among these. So at different times of the day, different times of our practice, different postures, you know, will be more or less appealing, more or less helpful. At the end of the day, it can be absolutely wonderful to just lay on the bed and just let everything, all the muscles relax and release. Let the bed support us. And even just this kind of scanning through the body, relaxing the body from the top of the head all the way to the toes, or tuning into the sensations of the breath, just being with each breath. So laying down meditation. It can be wonderful to walk. And what makes just a simple walk around the block or a walk in nature, walking meditation, is just this very simple shift into the intention to be with the experience of walking, the experience of the body walking, rather than being lost in our minds. And we're always going to be back and forth between those. But just to have that intention and set that intention completely opens up this way of being, and it sets something in motion. And then the sitting meditation. So it's sometimes said that when we when the energy is really low, walking and moving is helpful. And then when there's a lot of energy, or the energy's out of balance, there's anxiety or agitation or restlessness. Cultivating this ability to be still, even if it's just for 5 minutes, just to sit and just to, you know. Sometimes I tell myself to sit and don't even meditate. Even meditating is too much of a doing. Just to sit, and it's like sit and do nothing. Just sit and be. Just let the process of the body just do its thing. A book I'm reading now is a memoir written by a surgeon, a retired surgeon who specialized in transplants, in organ transplants, specifically liver transplants. And it's quite amazing to me to read and understand about how he or how a surgeon looks at the body, how a surgeon who is so trained in seeing not a person, not necessarily even a being, but just this system of organs, of blood vessels, of muscle, of tissue. And, you know, it's simply another way of seeing the body. And if one is a surgeon, it's a very, very useful way, you know, to be able to. I mean, he talked about one patient who, I mean, after having gone through, you know, these surgeries, which would take 10, 12 hours, and all the things that would happen in a surgery, then the patient was ready to go home from the hospital, and saw the surgeon walking in the hallway, reached out to shake his hand, and then collapsed. The surgeon immediately, you know, laid him on the floor and opened up his shirt and checked all his signs. And then he, being a transplant surgeon and caring for very, very sick people, he said that he always thinks about the worst case scenario for any symptom. Because when someone is very, very ill, even a very simple symptom like a pain or a thing could be the sign of something more serious. So he took his hand and I don't want to be too graphic about it, but basically went into the wound and felt around in his body, and then felt some liquid gushing from an artery that he could tell was a major artery, and put pressure on that artery and stopped the blood flow. And he said, okay, this guy needs to go back into surgery. And, you know, I say all this just to illustrate the possibilities, the ways of relating to this human body. And if we're not a surgeon, if we're not, you know, I mean, a lot of the things he talked about, I thought, I don't think I could ever do that. You know, I would never want to do that. This visceral resistance to seeing the body that way. And yet, I mean, this is just another thing I read about how there was a woman who was at a restaurant, and a very ordinary thing we do, we go out to eat, and she began choking. You know, she began choking on a piece of meat. Often when people are choking in public, they become embarrassed. And then they'll kind of quickly go to the bathroom. And this is actually the worst thing to do. You know, never, you know, do that, because we often need someone else to help us if we're really choking. And so This woman didn't do that, but she was choking, but she couldn't get the food dislodged. She was very fortunate in a way that she was not a doctor, but she was at the banquet after a big medical conference in the Central Valley, where at her table was, I think it was Francis Collins, who's the head of the NIH, National Institutes of Health, and a number of his colleagues who had just presented on, I think it was Valley Fever, one of the kind of things, one of the infections that happens that's endemic to the San Joaquin Valley. And so very quickly, one of the doctors jumped up and started to perform the Heimlich maneuver on her. Well, it wasn't working. And then another doctor went to do it, and it wasn't working. And slowly she was turning blue, basically, and losing oxygen, to her body. Then another doctor got up and he said, "Does anyone have a pocket knife?" Very calmly. Another doctor, produced the kind of pen knife. They laid the woman who was now unconscious, they laid her on the chair, and he proceeded to make a small incision in the throat, forget the area, but it's below the thyroid. The trachea. And he said, "Does anyone have a ballpoint pen?" A pen appears, breaks the pen in half. And into this small incision, he inserts half of the ballpoint pen and starts to breathe into it and makes a breathing tube. And then, within seconds, she was fine. And then, so to have a training, to have a willingness to see the body in this way can be a very useful thing. I was so taken by this, and I was so amazed that someone could actually just very calmly perform this minor procedure on someone with a pocket knife and a ballpoint pen. I looked up, and they actually sell these kind of, there's a tool that basically makes a little puncture and makes a breathing tube, and it's just a little thing you can have on your keychain. And so, I thought about this when I was reading the surgeon's book, and it said, that what is that resistance that I have to that kind of a squeamishness, or, I don't want to see the body as just this collection of vessels and organs and things. In these instructions on mindfulness of the body, the Buddha, he didn't talk about performing surgery or doing anything like that, but part of the instruction is learning to see the body as a collection of anatomical parts. So literally in the instructions it says going through to see the hair, the nails, the internal organs, the heart beating. It's just to regard the body in this way through the lens of the anatomy. Just think of why would the Buddha say this? Why to do this? And it may be, one of the reasons might be, is precisely to encounter that resistance, that squeamishness that I was feeling. We forget that the body is, it's just elements. In a way, it's just elements. It's just anatomy. It's just of the earth. And wind and all these constituent pieces. Seeing the body through this lens helps to remind us of impermanence. It helps to remind us that we are not beings that go on forever. that have always existed and always will exist. The body is, you know, impermanent. It's a collection of things that come together and that will fall away. Traditionally, this practice is said to be very helpful to counter the forces of not only attachment to the body, but attachment to other bodies in the form of lust, in the form of that kind of wanting mind. You know, we're bombarded with images of, you know, healthy, attractive bodies, but usually those bodies have their skin on, you know, the skin intact. And then when we look in a way that reminds us that, oh yeah, there's all these organs under the skin, that tends to kind of, it's not so attractive anymore. The person's not, you know, it could be the most attractive man or woman or model, but when you take off their skin, you know, that way of looking shifts. And again, it's not to say that, you know, it's just another way of looking. It's just another tool. So when we're caught in lust, when we're caught in desire, that can be helpful to remember and to know. The final practice that the Buddha talks about with mindfulness of the body, again, this is one that we don't often teach or talk about, is literally meditating on a corpse. You know, he would have monks, have practitioners go to watch the way that a dead body changes, the way a dead body decomposes and transforms. And again, this maybe has the function of helping us unhook from the enchantment with the body. After talking about these ways of seeing the body, I just want to remind us or reinforce that this is not a practice that is meant to negate the body or hate the body. Or we practice through the body. The body comes alive through our practice, through the practice of applying mindfulness. And the body is something to be cherished, to be respected, to be appreciated. As our mindfulness develops, as we build this capacity to just to simply be with the body in this way, immense amounts of joy, of pleasure, can light up the body. You know, the body becomes how and through we awaken, we experience this freedom that the Buddha talked about. So it's like this shift from the body being this source of suffering, this source of vulnerability, to the body itself, when we see it with mindfulness, becoming a refuge, becoming a place of safety, a place that we can return to no matter what's happening, no matter what circumstances are happening in the world or in our mind. We can ground ourselves with the body. And then through the body, we understand impermanence. We understand the truth of change. the truth of selflessness, that we don't own it. It's happening on its own. It's its own process. And what the Buddha said is when we see impermanence, when we see this selflessness, this is what enables the heart, the mind, to let go. You know, by seeing these truths and understanding these truths. So they're all right here. They're all right here in the body. We don't need to read a lot of books. We don't need to go to exotic places and learn, you know, esoteric things. Just in this body is everything we need to be awakened. So maybe that's enough for now. Thank you very much. Thank you for your attention and your that you come here, that your willingness to be here and do this practice not only helps you, but I think it helps all of us. You know, it's helpful to do this practice with other people. So it's, you know, we support each other, we awaken each other. That's so. Thank you very much.